Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Joe Lynham, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday, the 18th of June, these are the main stories. The EU's highest court has struck down a Hungarian law restricting foreign funding of NGOs, saying it must be scrapped. China has warned of unspecified countermeasures against the United States in retaliation for a law authorizing sanctions against Beijing officials over the mass detention of Uyghur Muslims. And
we'll meet again. Don't know where.
Vera Lynn, who entertained British troops during the Second World War, has died, aged 103. Also in this podcast, Burundi inaugurates a second president amid tight pandemic restrictions. And
right now, my community is not feeling safe in their own community. They're not feeling safe sitting on their front porch. They're not feeling safe going to the gas station. I want to put that safety back into their minds.
Changes this mother would like to see in the Black Lives Matter movement in Florida. We start in Central Europe. Ever since coming to power in Hungary a decade ago, its Prime Minister Viktor Orban has been accused of slowly eroding some of that country's democratic freedoms. 3 years ago, it severely restricted NGOs, such as charities and campaign groups, if they received most funding from abroad. Critics saw that as a way of attacking pro-democracy opponents, such as the billionaire US-Hungarian philanthropist George Soros. Now the Court of Justice of the European Union has ruled that the ban was discriminatory and unjustified. Our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt, told me more about the impact of that ban from 2017.
It severely restricted how NGOs got their funds. Basically, any organisation that received more than about $26,000 a year in foreign funds had to register as a foreign-supported organisation. It also had to publish the names of the donors. The Hungary's governing party, it's a nationalist right-wing government led by Viktor Orban, they said it was all about transparency. They said it was also about trying to clamp down on money laundering and terrorist financing. So that was the justifications for the law. And what you've seen is organisations that basically critical of the government that support policies, for example, such as liberal immigration policies, which is one of the policies that Viktor Orban is dead set against, that they can be targeted with fines or they could even be closed.
Has Budapest said anything? And I'm guessing there's no appeal to such a ruling from such a high court.
I haven't seen a reaction yet. They're bound to soon because they've known about this action for a long time. They're usually very vocal in defending their positions, similar to, for example, the disputes with other Central European countries such as Poland with the European Commission. So they will no doubt come out and express their opinion. What's going to be interesting is how it's applied. The ruling itself is worth noting. It was the Luxembourg-based court said it was basically providing restrictions on the free movement of capital in drawing a distinction between, you know, money provided from within Hungary and money coming from the outside.
Danny Eberhardt. China has strongly criticised new US legislation which could impose sanctions against senior Chinese Communist Party officials over their policy towards Muslim minorities in the region of Xinjiang. It's been widely reported that tens of thousands of mostly Muslim Uyghurs are being held there in detention camps. But the government has consistently claimed the camps offer voluntary education and training. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Zhao Lijian described Washington's decisions as a malicious attack and threatened unspecified countermeasures if the US went ahead with sanctions.
Once again, we urge the US to immediately correct its mistakes and stop using the act to harm China's interests and interfere in China's internal affairs. Otherwise, China will resolutely fight back, and the United States must bear all the consequences.
I spoke to our Shanghai correspondent Robin Brandt about these new sanctions.
Well, I mean, this is legislation passed unanimously by the Congress, and now it will become law. The Uyghur Human Rights Policy Act gives the Trump administration powers to target specific senior Communist Party officials in this country. People, it's believed, have been directly involved in the construction, the administration, the running of dozens of camps in the west of China, in the province of Xinjiang, where it is widely reported and widely believed that tens of thousands of Chinese Muslim minority Uyghur people are being held against their will. So the people involved in running those camps, I said building them, organizing them, could now be subject to travel bans or their private assets seized or frozen by U.S. authorities. At the same time, U.S. companies will be compelled or could be prosecuted for using any products or components that are manufactured in that part of China if that is believed to be done using forced manual labor of those people. So specific powers to target very senior people in this country.
The government in Beijing is talking about re-education and fighting terrorism. But what kind of retaliatory measures could it take?
Well, you're right. The justification and the defence that we hear repeatedly from Beijing is that these are re-education camps. Some of the people in some of them are free to come and go as they're pleased. That is much contested. And this is all part of a nationwide anti-terror campaign and also an anti-separatist campaign. It regards this legislation, unsurprisingly, in terms of the language, as an interference in what it sees as an internal matter. Xinjiang is absolutely no one else's business as far as China's leaders are concerned. In terms of the retaliation, we have no specifics. The foreign ministry has said it's firmly opposed and has expressed strong indignation in terms of what the Americans are doing. But the retaliation, well, who knows? You know, these two countries are still in the middle of a trade war. Perhaps tariffs may come into it. Perhaps some kind of diplomatic move. Perhaps it may be something more unofficial regarding maybe even at some point Americans here in this country. We just don't know. But what we do know is the Chinese are threatening retaliation.
Robin Brandt in Shanghai. A court in Pakistan has sentenced three men to life in prison for the murder of a Pakistani politician in London in 2010. Dr. Imran Farooq was stabbed to death outside his home by unidentified men, Sukunda Kamani reports.
Imran Farooq was a founding member of the MQM, a party that has played a crucial and controversial role in the politics of Pakistan's largest city, Karachi. He, like many other senior figures in the party, fled to London in the 1990s following a campaign by the security forces targeting their supporters accused of involvement in political violence. In 2010, he was murdered outside his home in North London. It's alleged the killing was the result of a feud within the MQM. Today, three men based in Pakistan were sentenced to life for their roles in the incident. The court in Pakistan has issued arrest warrants for three men living in London.
Sukunda Karmani. Now to the coronavirus pandemic. Official figures show more than 400,000 people worldwide have died from it, but that number might actually be an underestimate. How many people died because they couldn't get treatment for other illnesses? A BBC investigation has looked at 27 different countries, excluding the US, and has found that the total number of deaths caused by the virus, both directly and indirectly, is much higher. Sofia Betitsa has this report.
In a graveyard in Indonesia, a father buries his youngest son. He holds the tiny body, wrapped inside a white blanket. Rafa was three. He did not have coronavirus, but his parents say he died because of it. He had leukemia. His mum, Hasni, says that when his condition got worse, they raced him to at least four hospitals, but some were overwhelmed and others refused to admit him in case he had coronavirus.
I still believe that if my son was given prompt treatment, he would still be alive. But he was turned away and tossed from one hospital to another. I could do nothing.
Since the outbreak of the virus, lots of countries have been recording more deaths than usual. These are called excess deaths. Many of them have officially been linked to coronavirus, but many others, like Rafa's, have not. Our investigation found that Rafa is one of at least 130,000 people who have died during this pandemic, but not been included in the official figures.
Bella ciao, mamma.
That's exactly what happened with 78-year-old Luciana from Italy. At her funeral in Milan, friends from her choir celebrated the life of a tireless campaigner for human rights.
Ciao Luca.
Ciao Sofia. Diciamo che ho vissuto dei giorni migliori, ma...
Over a video call, her son Luca shows me a photo of the two of them at a gay pride march. His mum was being treated for pancreatic cancer, but when she tested positive for the coronavirus, doctors stopped her chemotherapy immediately. When it resumed 2 months later, the cancer had spread to and overwhelmed her liver.
Do you think that your mum would have lived for longer had she got the cancer treatment that she needed?
Yes, I believe so, because her doctor said everything was under control, as the cancer hadn't spread to her liver. My mom was optimistic, we made plans for the future, but the virus accelerated her death. She could have been with me for many more months, or even years.
A different country, a similar story of grief. In a flat in Sao Paulo, Brazil, Andrea's cat is feeding her 4 kittens. Andrea picks up one of them with a sad smile. Her own mum had a stroke recently. A few days after she came back from the hospital, her heart suddenly stopped beating.
My sister tried to beat her chest, but it didn't work. At the hospital, she would have been revived.
This is a country where the number of deaths is still on the rise. Andrea says her mum was discharged too soon.
My mother was a warrior who fought for her children all her life. And so many other people are dying in Brazil and in the world that they are not counting. It's scary.
Sofia Petitza reporting there. And the Bank of England has decided to pump an additional $125 billion into the financial system in Britain in response to what it calls the unprecedented situation caused by the coronavirus pandemic. The bank will create new money to buy British government bonds, an expansion of its policy known as quantitative easing. Our economics correspondent Andrew Walker reports.
The Bank of England's main policy-making committee described the economic outlook for Britain and the world as unusually uncertain. It would depend critically on the evolution of the pandemic, steps taken to contain it, and the response of households and businesses. The committee noted the massive decline, 20%, in economic activity in Britain, recently reported for April. It said there were subsequent signs of recovery, but nonetheless decided to increase its purchases of government bonds, a move which tends to push down interest rates across the economy and can encourage people to spend more. The economic crisis partly reflects people choosing to cut back spending and firms reducing investment.
That was our economics correspondent, Andrew Walker. Still to come on the Global News podcast. We remember the day that General de Gaulle spoke to the French nation from the BBC.
He appeared unannounced, unheralded, shortly before, I think, the 9 o'clock news, expecting to broadcast. By this time, we'd had instructions that we were not to put him on the air unless both the Foreign Office and the Ministry of Information had said OK.
Now to Burundi. The Central African nation has sworn in its newly elected president, Evariste Ndayishimiye, albeit 2 months earlier than planned. The fast-tracked ceremony comes after his predecessor, Pierre Nkurunziza, died suddenly last week. The new president was declared the winner of an election last month, which the opposition said was rigged. Our correspondent Mercy Juma is following developments from the Kenyan capital Nairobi and describes the colourful and unique inauguration with many coronavirus precautions in place.
citizens were hand sanitized at the entrance of the stadium. And, you know, they were being asked to, okay, definitely not all of them had masks. Very few people had masks because Burundi is one of the countries that has really, sorry to say, downplayed the issue of COVID-19. And there are also a few dignitaries present. We have, you know, the Vice President of Tanzania and Foreign Affairs Ministers of Equatorial Guinea and Congo Brazzaville.
Who is this new president, Evariste Ndayishimiye? What do we know about him?
Oh, great. So General Ndayishimiye, he's commonly known as Never, and he's a father of six. He was a law student. You said very well, he's been a close associate of former president, Pierre Nkurunziza. And in 2006, he served as Minister of Interior before moving to become the president's military advisor and then Secretary General. But he's commonly, you know, remembered and known for being one of the most influential generals since 2005, when Nkurunziza, his very close friend, then took power. So he's been serving in Nkurunziza's government ever since he took power until now that he's becoming the president.
And this new Burundian president is taking over a divided nation.
Indeed, Joe, he is. And, you know, his predecessor is accused of running a government that is unfortunately synonymous with human rights violations. It is a government that is on the record for oppressing the opposition, oppressing journalists and activists. And then right now, it's when the whole world is dealing with coronavirus, it is also one of the countries that has really not been keen on the implementation of the restrictions and just being open about coronavirus, and it's not an issue for them. And then lastly, we can also associate Burundi with so many refugees living outside the country after the failed coup attempt in 2015.
That was Mercy Juma. The death of the African-American George Floyd has galvanized people all over the world to go out on the streets and urge governments to promote race equality through the Black Lives Matter movement. Sabrina Fulton is the mother of Trayvon Martin, the 17-year-old who was killed by George Zimmerman, a civilian, in 2012. Mr. Zimmerman's acquittal, however, sparked national outrage and demands for justice and fueled the Black Lives Matter movement. Trayvon Martin's mother, Sabrina Fulton, has just qualified to run for public office in Florida's Miami-Dade area. Carney Sharp spoke to her about the current movement in the U.S. and abroad.
A lot of people are woke. Some people are waking up and some people are still asleep. And so with the traumatic killing of George Floyd on video, I think that kind of opened a lot of people's eyes of the fight of the African Americans, because before we were just telling people the struggle that we had to go through with racial inequality and racial profiling and those things. And now they were able to actually see what African Americans and people of color have to go through. So this was nothing new for us. This was America opening their eyes to the ugly truth about how we are being treated here.
What changes would you like to see when it comes to the police force? What would be the number one constructive change so that African-American young boys like Trayvon are not killed?
Let me just point out that the person that shot and killed Trayvon was not a police officer. He was a wannabe police officer. But one of the major changes that we need to make is to make sure that police are being held accountable. For so long, even here in Miami, Florida, they have not charged the police with murdering an African-American in 27 years. And so that's just unheard of. And so a lot of places all over the United States, they don't charge the police. And so we got to fix that. We got to make sure that there's some type of reform in place where police are being held accountable. Because if you know you can go to a bank and rob it and you're not going to be held accountable, you can just go run off with the money, you're going to rob the bank. And so we got to make sure that when there's a loss of life, that people are not so nonchalant about it and they value the life that they've taken. And the only way that they can value that life is by making sure that they are arrested. A full investigation is done by an outside party, a third party, and that person is prosecuted and convicted and goes to jail when you know that you're taking a life for no reason.
And if you get into office, Sabrina, what change would you like to bring then to your local community?
Right now, my community is not feeling safe in their own community. They're not feeling safe sitting on their front porch. They're not feeling safe going to the gas station, going to the grocery store, going to the ATM machine. They don't feel safe. I want to put that safety back into their minds. I want them to get to know the police officers and law enforcement that's in their area. I want them to get to know them on a first name basis. I want law enforcement in turn to get to know the residents as well. If something happens in my community, I should not feel threatened by calling the police or letting the police know what I've seen.
Sabrina Fulton, mother of the murdered teenager Trayvon Martin. New research by the University of Queensland indicates that giant footprints found in a disused mine belong to Australia's biggest predatory dinosaur. Paleontologists established that the footprints were up to 150 million years old. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
The footprints suggest a dinosaur almost as big as a Tyrannosaurus rex once roamed Australia. Analysis by the University of Queensland estimates this huge meat-eating predator was about 10 metres long and 3 metres tall. The tracks were found in the ceilings of old coal mines in the 1950s, but were only recently scientifically examined. Queensland has been a trove for paleontologists. Fossils indicate it was home to an Ankylosaurus, which was covered in bony armour to protect it from carnivores.
Phil Mercer in Sydney. President Macron is in London today to mark the 80th anniversary of Charles de Gaulle's famous wartime broadcast on the BBC. On the evening of June 18, 1940, shortly after the fall of France, General de Gaulle came to this very building, Broadcasting House, and delivered an historic call to arms, urging the people of occupied France not to give up the fight. But as our diplomatic correspondent James Landale reports, the broadcast almost never happened.
Now here is a statement in French of great importance to our French listeners by General de Gaulle.
It's June the 18th, 1940, and France has fallen to the Nazis. A little-known French officer has fled to London and managed to get himself in front of a BBC microphone.
J'invite tous les Français qui veulent rester libres à m'écouter et à me suivre.
Charles de Gaulle was France's most junior general. He had no authority from his government, which had capitulated to the Nazis, and yet he delivered a passionate call to arms, arguing that France had lost a battle, but not the war. I'm standing outside No. 4 Carlton Gardens in central London, where Charles de Gaulle made his headquarters for the Free French Forces. There's a rather fetching statue of the great man, and there's also a plaque bearing some of the words he broadcast to the world. And I'm joined by the French ambassador to London, Catherine Colonna. Ambassador, can you tell us, why is this speech so important?
It was a strong message of resistance and a strong message of hope, meaning that there will be a victory over fascism, that Europe and France will be liberated.
He was tall, good-looking, very impressive to go.
Driving Charles de Gaulle around London in those days was a young English woman called Olivia Matthews. The general had no official car at first, so she borrowed her father's.
It was a big black car. It looked rather impressive. Nobody had smart cars in those days. And funny enough, I was fairly good at it.
That was because Olivia, aged just 21, had been driving an ambulance for the French army, for which she was awarded the Croix de Guerre. She too had escaped France and was now working for the Free French in London. Olivia Jordan, as she now is 101. The extraordinary thing is that de Gaulle's June 18 broadcast almost never happened. The cabinet was opposed, Winston Churchill had to overrule them, and even then, no one told the BBC the general was on his way.
He appeared unannounced and unheralded shortly before, I think, the 9 o'clock news, expecting to broadcast.
Elizabeth Barker, at the time a young BBC producer, was interviewed for the BBC Oral History Collection in 1983.
By this time, we'd had instructions that we were not to put him on the air unless both the Foreign Office and the Ministry of Information had said OK. Well, there was I downstairs having to tell the general that we could not put him on the air until we had got an OK from the highest British authority.
After some hurried telephone calls, permission was finally granted by an official at the Ministry of Information, and an impatient de Gaulle was allowed on air.
L'honneur, le bon sens, l'intérêt supérieur de la patrie commande à tous les Français libres de continuer le combat.
Few heard that first speech. Indeed, the BBC did not even record it. But de Gaulle repeated different versions in coming days, and newspapers printed the text. And 80 years on, such is its centrality to France's national story that no quarantine or lockdown will prevent the country's president coming here to mark the anniversary.
James Landale reporting. And now to another voice which stirred millions of hearts during the Second World War, Dame Vera Lynn, whose talent as a singer helped raise morale during those wartime years, has died at the age of 103. Vera Lynn became known as the Force's sweetheart to people around the Commonwealth. She was also a frequent guest of honour at events remembering the war years, well into her 90s. Our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd looks back at her long career.
There'll be blue. Just you wait and see.
The voice of Vera Lynn, born Vera Welsh in the East End of London, became a symbol of home and safety for millions of people in the Second World War. There was a natural warmth and sincerity. From 1941, she had a show on BBC Radio for the troops called Sincerely Yours, Vera Lynn.
I wasn't a glamorous type. They didn't look at me as a sort of a pin-up kind. But I did bring messages of love and hope, brought the parted ones that little bit nearer together.
Attempts to turn her into a screen star didn't work, but men of the armed services voted Vera Lynn the Force's sweetheart. Her career didn't fade post-war. When Britain's first official charts came out in 1952, Vera Lynn Records took 3 of the top 10 places.
With love that's true, I'll wait for you.
She became a dame in 1975. Dame Vera campaigned for better pensions for war widows, and for decades she was hugely in demand at events commemorating World War II. And one of the early songs still evokes that conflict, even to those born much later.
We'll meet again, don't know where, don't know where.
When in the uncertainty of the coronavirus pandemic, the Queen addressed the nation and the world, there was an unmissable echo of an old song. We will be with our families again, she said. We will meet again. There had been no explicit reference to the Vera Lynn song, but the meaning was understood nonetheless, even after so many years.
But I know it.
Dame Vera Lynn, who's died at the age of 103. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Joe Lynham. Until next time, goodbye.